Good day, and welcome to today's immigration conference. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you'll have the opportunity to ask questions during a question-and-answer session. To register to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch-tone telephone at any time. Please note today's call may be recorded, and I will be standing by if you should need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Mariya Lena Encapia. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you so much, Erica. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. My name is Mariya Lena Encapia, and I am the Executive Director of the National Immigration Law Center. As you all know by now, earlier this week, the Trump administration finalized the public charge regulation, a racially motivated wealth test that, if implemented, would impact millions of families across this country. This pernicious regulation would create a Byzantine structure designed to send one message and one message only. If you're not white and wealthy, you are no longer welcome in this country, the land of opportunity. As the only national organization dedicated exclusively to ensuring that today's immigrants who earn low incomes have similar opportunities that previous generations of immigrants and refugees have had, we have had over 24 people on our team preparing to fight back. I am so proud to join our plaintiffs and co-counsel to announce that at this very moment, while we're on this call with you, we are in the process of filing our lawsuit, Clínica de la Raza et al. Versus Trump et al., which we believe is the first community-driven lawsuit challenging this regulation. Joining us in this lawsuit are our co-counsel partners, the Asian Americans Advance in Justice, Los Angeles, the National Health Law Program, and the Western Center on Law and Poverty. Our plaintiffs represent a diverse array of civil rights and human services organizations. They are healthcare providers, workers' rights advocates, child and maternity health experts, and leaders of Asian Pacific Islander, Black, Muslim, Arab, South Asian, and Latinx communities. They represent the richness and diversity of our country, and they have already seen that this regulation is taking a catastrophic toll on our communities. And that is why this lawsuit is so critical to our nation. The Trump administration's public charge rule is unlawful on three fronts. First, it violates the Administrative Procedures Act by enacting a new regulation in an arbitrary and capricious manner. Second, it violates our nation's equal protection guarantee enshrined in the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution. And third, the regulation is also invalid because it was promulgated by the unlawfully appointed acting director, Ken Cuccinelli, in violation of the Constitution's Appointments Clause and the Federal Vacancies Reform Act. These legal violations are part of the Trump administration's playbook, which we've been so familiar with. From the start, he has shown breathtaking disregard for the guardrails of democracy provided in our founding documents. Whether by summarily terminating DACA or temporary protected status, or by unlawfully attempting to insert a citizenship question into the U.S. Census, the courts have been a crucial check and balance on the Trump administration's lawlessness time and time again. Today, we will once again ask the federal court in the Northern District of California to play this critical role. We are asking the court to block the administration from implementing this racially motivated rule and to ultimately strike it down as unlawful and unconstitutional. Joining me today are several of the plaintiffs and lawyers working on this case. Our first speaker is one of our courageous plaintiffs. Carmela Castellano-Garcia is the president and CEO of the California Primary Care Association. Carmela?
Good morning, and thank you for having me on this call today. As mentioned, my name is Carmela Castellano-Garcia. I am president and CEO of the California Primary Care Association, also known as CPCA. CPCA is the membership association that represents California's 1,300 community health centers who treat 7 million patients. That's one in six Californians. CPCA has been heavily invested in advocating for the rights of our patients and ensuring that health centers continue to have the opportunity to provide comprehensive care to anyone who walks through our doors, regardless of their immigration status. And CPCA is proud to stand with our immigrant and legal partners to oppose changes to the public charge rule, which, if implemented, will have a devastating impact on our patients and our communities. The mission of community health centers is to treat everyone who walks through our doors. Everyone deserves access to care, and the public charge rule will be an obstacle to that mission. Now, since the leaked executive order on public charge, California health centers have reported an increase in mental health concerns in our patient population. We also understand from patient activity in our health centers that the chilling effect of these changes has already been driving entire families away from enrolling in programs or has compelled them to disenroll from programs. These are programs that help them stay healthy and pay for medical care at community health centers. Now, when immigrant families no longer enroll in public benefits, they will need to rely on state public health and other under-resourced systems at a significant cost to states and localities. An example would be increased utilization of emergency rooms as a form of primary health care, or individuals having to delay treatment until medical conditions become more severe and ultimately more costly to treat. Our association predicts that hundreds of thousands of our members' patients will disenroll from Medi-Cal as a result of the final rule. Our health centers will lose millions of dollars in revenue, and our patients will lose access to health care insurance. Now, this will lead to an increase in uninsured patients, and we do anticipate that many of these patients will continue to seek services at community health centers, and we will incur increased costs of serving the uninsured. Health centers have seen dramatic growth and financial stability as a result of the Affordable Care Act. We have enrolled millions of patients. Now, if our patients start to disenroll out of fear, patients who are even eligible for care, this will severely impact health centers and a cascading negative impact to employees, to patients, and ultimately communities that we serve. If these policy changes go into effect, it will no longer be possible to assure patients that using Medicaid or other health benefits won't affect their ability to adjust their immigration status. This will be a tremendous barrier, not only for the immigrant community, but for entire communities served by community health centers. So in closing, I want to make it very clear, not only will the expansion of this public charge rule deter many immigrants from accessing public programs, but it will deter parents from enrolling their children, including children with legal immigrant status, in services for which they're legally eligible, even if the rules don't apply to them. And CPCA and health centers across the state want to reassure our patients that community health centers will remain a safe space for everyone who seeks services. We maintain our commitment to serve everyone, no matter their immigration status, and we will educate our patients and providers on this final public charge rule and the implications it has on them. As I have said, the mission of community health centers is to treat everyone who walks through our doors. Everyone deserves access to care, and this public charge rule will be an obstacle to our mission. We will do everything within our power to stop it. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Carmela, and thank you for your leadership and for courageously standing up with community health centers to fight the Trump administration against this rule. I'd like to pass this on next to our co-counsel, Antoinette Dozier, senior attorney with the Western Center on Law and Poverty. Antoinette?
Good morning, and thank you for having me. Once again, my name is Antoinette Dozier. I'm a senior attorney with Western Center on Law and Poverty. Western Center fights to end poverty in California, and this public charge rule dramatically expands both the definition of public charge, the totality of the circumstances test, which is applied, as well as the types of benefits that would be considered in evaluating whether or not someone is a public charge. We believe the consideration of these non-cash benefits and the expansion of the definition of public charge will deeply impact low and moderate income working families who depend primarily on income from employment, but who receive these non-cash supplemental benefits in order to improve their quality of life and their communities. These non-cash programs help millions of citizens and immigrants to remain healthy and productive in their communities where rent and other cost of living is high. We are working to fight back against this racist and abusive policy. Our co-counsel, like Western Center, our co-counsel's mission is to improve the health, economic well-being, and housing of all families in every California community and nationwide, whatever their race, religion, or income. And we'd rather be doing this by helping them get health care and food and homes that they need to thrive. But if the Trump administration and its white nationalist agenda become an obstacle to that mission, of course, we're going to sue them. Our claims, as mentioned before, include challenges to the proposed or the final rule under the Administrative Procedure Act. We believe that the regulation is contrary to the statute, as well as is arbitrary and capricious. It distorts the totality of the circumstances that the public charge statute prescribes. It sets forth a series of arbitrary factors that are not reasonably related to whether or not a person would become a public charge, like English proficiency, credit scores, high school graduation. Most of the factors are negatively weighted, which significantly and arbitrarily tip the scales in favor of finding an applicant, particularly applicants who are either low or moderate working class, as public charge. We are asking the court to enjoin the implementation of the rule and fully expect that to happen through the course of the litigation.
Thank you, Antoinette, and thank you and your team at the Western Center on Law and Poverty for bringing your expertise in the fight for all low-income immigrants to have the same opportunities. Our last speaker is Yanine Senachai, who is a staff attorney at Asian Americans Advance in Justice in Los Angeles. Yanine?
Hi, everyone. My name is Yanine Senachai. I work at Asian Americans Advancing Justice, Los Angeles. We are an immigrant and civil rights organization. Asian American communities have a connected history to public charge. The first law to ban immigration based on race was the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, which was the same year the term public charge first appeared in a statute. The Chinese Exclusion Act has been abolished, and since 1965, all other racial quotas have been abolished. That year, the family-based immigration system, which is the cornerstone of our immigration system, was established, and it has been the primary path for many Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders to obtain legal residency. In recent years, 40% of the millions of individuals and families waiting in long backlogs for family-based immigration are actually from Asian and Pacific Island nations. According to a recent Migration Policy Institute report, over 300,000 recent LPRs, green card holders from Asia, had two or more negative factors under the rule, putting them at risk of green card denials. That means literally hundreds of thousands of families that could be torn apart or remain separated because of this unconstitutional regulation. Some of the negative factors, as Antoinette just explained, include arbitrary factors such as limited English proficiency and credit history, which most of our communities do not have access to. The regulation could chill up to 3.2 million Asian Americans from using vital health, nutrition, and housing benefits that they need to thrive. The regulation is just another devastating effort by this administration to suppress immigration from non-white countries. The plaintiffs in this lawsuit have clients and members who will be directly harmed by this regulation in terms of denials of green cards and being forced to give up vital benefits. We join our co-counsel in asking for an injunction that stops the regulation from taking place.
Thank you so much, Yanine. And now we'd like to open up the lines for question and answers from the media. Erica, can you please give instructions for folks?
Certainly. As a reminder at this time, if you would like to ask a question, it is the star and one on your touchtone telephone. If at any point you find your question has been answered, you may remove yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. Again, that is the star and one, and we'll go first to the line of Ted Hessen from Politico. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning, and thank you all for holding the call. One thing that caught my attention in the complaint in particular was the call to invalidate acting USCIS Director Ken Cuccinelli's appointment. And I was wondering if there was any precedent for that, if there had been other instances where political appointments had been invalidated or that regulations had been vacated based on an invalid appointment?
Thank you for the question, Ted. Antoinette or Yanine, do you guys want to take that? If not, we can add here.
Yes, this is Yanine. I am not aware of a precedent for this, but we do believe that one of the reasons the regulation is unlawful is because of the invalid appointment of the acting director.
And my colleague Myra Joachim will answer here from NILC as well.
Yes, hi, this is Myra Joachim, staff attorney at the National Immigration Law Center. What we do understand is that acting director Kevin Cuccinelli was appointed in procedures that have violated the procedures that have been established under the Federal Vacancies Reform Act. And we are aware that there have been other examples in the past where invalid appointments generally have occurred. One example is in the NLRB case, and Ted, we can certainly follow up with you to provide you additional citations for that. What we also understand is that as of right now, this is the first litigation that is challenging the public charge rule that is bringing this claim. It has not been raised in the other two lawsuits that have been filed, although the complaint filed by the multi-state attorney generals in Washington does indicate that there are legal questions challenging this appointment.
Great. Thank you, Ted. Operator, next question.
Certainly. We'll go next to the line of Micah Rosenberg.
Yeah, hi. This is Micah Rosenberg from Reuters. I had a question about the APA charge and just sort of comparing this to other, legal challenges that have been brought against Trump administration policies that haven't gone through the whole, notice and comment period. This rule obviously sort of went through that process and had, hundreds of thousands of comments. Do you think that sort of complicates the APA charge at all, or what can be, what do you see as sort of countering the government's arguments that this has kind of gone through the complete process?
Great. Why don't we start with Antoinette? Would you like to answer that on the APA claim?
Sure. So the Administrative Procedure Act actually has prescriptions that disallow agencies from enacting new regulations that are contrary to law. So even if an agency goes through the notice and comment period, but the ultimate regulation that they try to enact is contrary to law, it can be invalidated. And that's what we argue here, that there is a long well-established meaning of public charge that Congress has considered, and that the final rule promulgated by the Department of Homeland Security is in fact contrary to that law. The other aspect of it is that the Administrative Procedure Act describes certain rules and laws around how a regulation is enacted, even through the notice and comment period, so that agencies must adequately consider the comments that have been submitted if they are revising or changing a previously enacted regulation. They have to consider and the extent to which the reasons that support their change is adequately explained. And here the agency did not adequately consider and respond to the comments that were submitted, and it also did not adequately explain the reasons why it has departed from long-standing, well-established public charge definition and test. So despite the notice and comment process, the agency can't simply go through that process without still adhering to the other aspects of the law that require and that should ultimately result in a lawful regulation.
Thank you so much for that, Antoinette. Yanine, did you want to add to this?
Sure. I also wanted to add that factors under this new totality of circumstances test, such as ability to speak English and credit history, the agency did not do its job of explaining how those factors are reasonably related to predicting whether or not one is likely to become a public charge.
Great. Thanks for that addition, Yanine. And Micah, this is Marielena. I would just add a couple of other things, given our work at the National Immigration Law Center in terms of suing the Trump administration and a number of other cases like the Muslim ban, the waivers, DACA, termination of DACA, et cetera. One of the things that we've seen is, as you might recall, when the administration first went, well, when there was a leaked draft of the administration's intent on public charge, it was actually a draft executive order. They pulled that and then decided to go through the notice and comment period. But in fact, what we've seen, as Antoinette just mentioned, is despite the fact that over a quarter million of Americans, the majority of whom oppose this public rule, the administration ultimately has made very few changes and did not take the time to do that. And as Antoinette mentioned, we also have a record, a long legislative history of Congress making many, many changes legislatively, but not making changes in, to the definition of public charge for decades. And that was not the case with Muslim ban or DACA, for example, or some of the other lawsuits against the administration using the APA claim, which is one of the reasons we believe that in addition to the fact that very recently, even as recent as last year, when Congress refused to take up the RAISE Act, which is basically the merit-based system that the Trump administration has been pushing, and frankly is at the root of what they're trying to do, which is to change the face of America and to have immigrants in the future only be those who are white and wealthy. Congress failed to do that. They rejected that. And yet the Trump administration has decided to do an end run around Congress, which is a violation of the APA. So thank you for your question, Micah. Operator, next question.
Thank you. And we'll go next to the line of Maria Pena from Telemundo. Please go ahead.
Yes. Good morning, and thank you for doing this call. I do have a couple of questions, but I'll try to keep them short. One, do you foresee this going all the way up to the Supreme Court as another immigrant measures? Two, why are you making the case about invalidating Cuccinelli's appointment when he didn't make up the rule? It was the administration making this change in the public charge rule. And the last question, can you give us an example of a prominent immigrant who would have been banned had this change happened before, had this public charge rule been made before?
Thank you, Maria. So let's start with some of the questions on Cuccinelli. Yanine or Antoinette, do you guys want to take that?
I mean, the fact that he wasn't around when the rule was first promulgated doesn't mean that we can't challenge the rule on the basis of his invalid appointment. With our equal protection claim under the Fifth Amendment, we are alleging that defendants' administration, including Mr. Cuccinelli, acted with improper discriminatory intent and bias against non-white immigrants in promulgating the regulation. And his invalid appointment,
which is
an additional argument to that.
Great. Thank you, Antoinette. And Yanine, is there anything you wanted to add to the questions?
Sorry, that was just Yanine speaking. That was just me speaking.
Oh, sorry about that. I thought it was Antoinette. Apologies for that. Yes, for the record, we want to make sure folks, reporters know that was Yanine speaking. Antoinette, would you like to add anything?
No, thank you.
Okay, thanks. So, Maria, just really quickly, on the Supreme Court, hard to know whether this will go up. I think the one thing that we know and we've seen through our other litigation at the National Immigration Law Center is the administration does not follow rules, does not follow procedures, including the normal process of litigation through the courts. They have repeatedly tried to jump over the appellate process, for example, in our DACA case, which is now before the Supreme Court. So very likely they would do something similar here, but I'm not going to try to guess what they will do. The last thing on your question about people who have been affected by, you know, who would have been affected by this rule, we strongly believe at the National Immigration Law Center that we will start learning about hundreds of thousands of people who will hopefully share their story. I will tell you, even just this week, as I've talked to reporters, even reporters themselves have shared their story with me personally on phone calls. I am getting tons of text messages, tweets, and emails from people saying, this is my family story. We would not be allowed here. So, you know, I'll just say, you know, for myself, you know, as the head of the National Immigration Law Center, an organization focused on low-income immigrants, many of our staff members also have family members who would not have qualified under the public charge. I personally would not be here today. My family came from Colombia in the 1970s. I'm the youngest of 10. My mother and father had all of the factors that are included, negative adverse factors, the fact that they had 10 children, the fact that they didn't speak English, the fact that they were sometimes laid off and unemployment wasn't enough for them to feed and support all of us. We needed to rely on food stamps for short periods of time. All of those factors would have meant that my father would not have been able to petition for us to get a green card. He was initially brought here to work in the textile factories and had an employment-based visa, the exact type of person who would be blocked and denied from that. And I am very clear that my family is what makes America great, just like many of all of everybody on this call today. So the anti-poverty programs that we benefited from, frankly, are what allowed us to be self-sufficient today and to stand on our two feet and to contribute greatly to this nation.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Operator, next question.
Yes, we'll go next to the line of Quinn Owen from ABC News.
Hi. Thanks, everyone, for doing this call. I'm wondering, is there any estimate or firm number? I know Yanine spoke a bit about this earlier, but on the any kind of estimated impact that you all are anticipating for this rule, we know there's a group, there's a population of about 223 million people who live in households with non-citizens or are non-citizens themselves. What percentage of them do you anticipate might be affected? And then for Carmela, do you anticipate that community health centers will have to close as a result of this rule?
Great. Thank you so much for the questions. Carmela, why don't we start with you, please?
Well, we certainly know that there will be a devastating impact on community health centers, and that includes financially, because when people disenroll in programs and they don't have the financial backing for the services. But the exact impact to health centers is hard to predict, as each health center is different and offers different services. So ultimately, it'll be a center-by-center impact, and we'll have to see. So we do not know what will ultimately occur.
Antoinette, do you want to answer the first question on the statistics? Might be on mute.
Yes, I'm sorry. I was on mute.
So no worries.
I don't have an exact number of how many would be impacted. We know that the impact will be significant, and we know that under a similar definition of public charge, which has applied to individuals seeking to enter the United States from abroad, public charge exclusions based on public charge have increased almost 1,000-fold. And so we know that this will have a disproportionate impact on individuals from countries where the majority are non-white. So we know that at least based upon a recent study of recently admitted lawful permanent residents, 60% of those from Mexico and Central American two negative factors, 41% from Asian countries, 40% from South American, and 34% from African countries had at least two of the negative factors and would likely have been considered a public charge and under the new rule. So it will be a significant percentage of those seeking to both adjust the status to lawful permanent resident, those who are seeking to extend their visas or change the visa. I don't we don't have the exact number, but I think the impact will be significant.
Great. Thank you, Antoinette. And this is Mariela, and I would just add the Migration Policy Institute, which has been working with us to basically do the research and do the analysis, they share that out of approximately 940,000 people that were granted green cards in fiscal year 2017 and not including refugees and other humanitarian admissions, about 650,000 of them would have been at risk of denial for having at least one of the negative factors, and then about 400,000 would have at least two of those. So we can definitely send that information to you along so you have those the link to that statistics and also connect you directly to them. Thank you for your question. Operator, are there any other questions in the queue?
Certainly there are. And just as a reminder, it is star and one if you would like to ask a question. We'll go next to Michaela Ross from Bloomberg Government.
Great. Thanks so much for hosting this call. I was hoping if there's anything else that could be said about what you think the outlook for the cases. I know you touched a little bit about if this would make it to the Supreme Court, how quickly you would expect this to be enjoined would be, you know, a question. But then also just, you know, comparing how quickly this is going to move in the courts versus how quickly this would actually be implemented. It sounds like the agency, you know, with already a backlog, would have a lot of work and training to implement this. And so I'm wondering, you know, are these negative effects going to be slowed in any way because of that?
Great. Thank you for your question. Yanine or Antoinette, do you guys want to, or even Carmela, do you guys want to respond to any of those points?
To your question, like the agency, those working within the agency have even admitted that it would, you know, pose a huge burden for them to begin implementing the new test. So that is going to be a problem with that. With respect to timeline for the litigation, that is very difficult to predict.
Go ahead, Antoinette. Yep.
I would just add that although the timeline is difficult to predict, the hope is, of course, that we would be able to prevent the full implementation and the harmful effects from full implementation of the rule, which goes into effect October 15th.
Right. Thank you for that, Antoinette. Yeah, this is Mariela, and I was just going to add that since we do have it doesn't go into effect until the 15th of October, and they have 60 days to implement. But one of the things that we've seen through I believe FOIAs and emails that Ted Hessen obtained is that the White House has been very clear that they want to rush this entire process. They've been trying to rush it for the last month. We wouldn't be surprised they're going to continue that pressure will continue on the agency. And then lastly, I'll just say that we at the National Immigration Law Center and our co-counsel have been preparing for this lawsuit for about a year, and we feel very confident that the courts will eventually strike this down. We hope that the courts will act swiftly in a matter of days and weeks before the law goes into effect on October 15th, because we've already seen the humanitarian impact that this is having on children and families in communities across the nation. Thanks for your question again. Operator, any other questions in the queue?
We have no further questions, but as a reminder, that is the star and one. Again, star and one. We'll pause momentarily for any questions to queue.
Great. And while we wait to see if there are any questions, just want to take a moment to thank all of our brave plaintiffs on the lawsuit. In addition to California Primary Care Association and our lead plaintiff, La Clínica de la Raza, our plaintiffs also include Maternal and Child Health Access, the Farm Worker Justice, Council on American Islamic Relations California Chapter, of African Communities Together, Legal Aid Society of San Mateo County, Central American Resource Center, and the Korean Resource Center. And we are grateful for their courage. We know that in this moment in our country, being able to stand up against this administration and sue this administration is both a great risk to organizations and individual plaintiffs, but also an act of patriotism. Operator, any other questions?
We have no questions.
Great. Thank you so much. Thanks to everybody for joining us today on the call. If you have any additional questions, please email media@nilc.org so that someone can be in touch with you shortly. We will connect you to any of today's speakers or any of our other plaintiffs on the case. Thanks again, and have a great day.